Good day, and welcome to the city-hosted Market Insight on Community Development. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mark Dean, National Product Manager, City Community Capital. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Ron. Good morning to those on the West Coast, and good afternoon to those on the East Coast. This is Mark Dean. I'd like to thank you and welcome you all for calling in and participating on our first installment of the 2017 series of City Community Capital Market Insights on Community Development. This is something that we've been doing for probably about 3 or 4 years now, bringing to our clients what we like to refer to as intellectual capital as well as economic capital. One of the things that's different this year or this with this webinar than we've done with others, and it's a bit of an experiment, and I think it's going to turn out well, is for those of you who have joined online, you should see that you've been prompted to answer 6 questions to the right of the screen that are multiple choice questions that are intended to give us as the panelists and the speakers an idea of who you are, how the changes in the market have been affecting you, and kind of what your outlook is. So the poll's going to stay open for a few more minutes. If you haven't had a chance to do that, as I go through kind of the program today and talk about our speakers, we'll keep the poll open and would ask that all of you take the time to do that. Because I think it'll be interesting for us as well as interesting for people who are attending to know kind of who the audience is and also their perspective on some things. So as the operator said, my name is Mark Dean. I'm the National Production Manager for City Community Capital. I basically run the debt platform for City. I think many of you on this phone call know City as a leading provider of what I'll refer to as economic capital, debt and equity, construction debt, firm debt, all sorts of things, economic capital for affordable housing. We started this webinar series, a number of years ago in an attempt to bring intellectual capital. And while we're here today to talk about the status of the low-income housing tax credit market, we also have webinars throughout the year, including interviews with the heads of Fannie and Freddie on the affordable side, generally an economist update. We've had some interesting information from the real estate sales community. So, again, we do about 5 to 6 of these a year. This is the first installment. This is one of the better attended webinars that we've done. Looking at our guests today, we had over 1,000 people register. It was a broad spectrum of for-profit developers, not-for-profit developers, financiers, other lenders, other equity investors, state HFAs, local housing authorities. So it's a really broad brush on who participates these today. So we hope that what it does is it provides you some perspective from what I would consider industry leaders, particularly on the LIHTC space, about what's going on. So I'm going to kind of walk through the agenda. And, Charlene, if you want to go ahead and advance the slideshow, I'm going to kind of spend a little bit of time talking about our agenda and then also talking about who our panelists are today. So when we talk today, let me tell you what this discussion is not. This is not a discussion about, hey, what do we think is happening in the House and the Senate? But we may get into some of that. But it's not a discussion about the political aspects and what's going to happen to the LIHTC business. It's really more of a tactical discussion. And kind of the theme of this I stole from Janet Yellen in a Fed comment she made, which is operating under a cloud of uncertainty at the moment. Obviously, the LIHTC market is operating under a cloud of uncertainty. I don't know today that we'll have any more certainty, but you'll certainly have a good insight and perspective on the market. So, and we're going to get a unique perspective because our guests today represent direct investors on the LIHTC space, syndicators on the LIHTC space, and then a blend of syndicators and direct investors. I'm going to ask them some questions about what 2016 looked like for them, pre and post general election, and then a whole host of questions that will be relative to operating in 2017. We'll have time for Q&A at the end of this. Charlene, if you want to go ahead and advance. As well as there will be an opportunity for participants to go to submit questions during the webinar, and I'll have a slide here in just a moment with that address. So, again, if you've joined, complete the poll if you can. I'm going to talk a little bit about our speakers, and I'm delighted that these gentlemen agreed to participate with us today. I think the first gentleman, they all don't need introductions, but the first gentleman certainly doesn't need an introduction. Jack Manning, who's the president and CEO of Boston Capital. Jack goes back well before the inception of the LIHTC program and has been an incredibly active participant in providing leadership at Boston Capital in working through the LIHTC process. Boston Capital, I'm sure, is a name that is familiar to many, if not all of you on the phone. They are a key syndicator partner of ours at Citi. They're somebody that I've been doing this for about 20 years now, and they've been involved with me personally for 20 plus years. So we're pleased to have Jack participate with us, and Jack will be obviously providing a wealth of knowledge just historically over the program, but from the perspective of the syndicator, a lot of different probably feedback from investors and that sort of stuff. So that's going to be exciting. Next we have Christoph Gabler from Aegon. Aegon is also a party that we've done business with for a long time. I think I probably go back, my interactions with Aegon go back to the early 90s. Christoph runs their affordable housing platform. And Aegon is a unique, will bring a unique perspective to this today because Aegon is obviously not only a syndicator, but also a direct investor. So Aegon is also somebody that we at Citi consider to be one of our most key strategic partners and somebody who, quite candidly, in the turmoil that has occurred since the general election, is somebody that we've worked a lot with and I think has shown leadership in the market. So next, Charlene. And then as I talk about Mark Sherman, I would ask if anybody hasn't completed the poll, if you could take the last few seconds and do that. We're going to close the poll after I introduce Mr. Sherman. So I've had the pleasure of working with Mark Sherman for about 10 years. Mark has become an integral part of Citi Community Capital in a complementary group to the group that I run, which is Structured Lending and Investing. And Mark is a key component in providing leadership to our tax credit initiative, which I think last year was in excess of $1 billion of LIHTC investments. Mark is going to join us today providing a perspective of an investor from a syndicator standpoint, and then also something that Citi has been looking at is on a standpoint. So, again, kind of a couple of unique perspectives. So, Charlene, let's go to the Q&A portion, or to the Q&A slide, please. So as we go through, and I'm going to start the dialogue here shortly, but you can, if you'd like to email a question, the phone lines will be muted until the end of the call, but then we'll open it up for questions. If you have a burning desire to ask a question and can't wait till the end, you can certainly email it to askcitycommunitycapital@citi.com. The email address is on the slide here. Or if you have a question and you don't want to ask it, certainly go ahead and email it in. So, Charlene, looks like you've closed the polls, and I don't know if our participants can see the results. Charlene?
Yes, they should be able to see the poll results.
Okay. So we've got a lot of finance people on the call, but, you know, over 100 developers, some state HFAs, some PHAs, a lot of finance professionals. You know, from looking at the next question about expecting to close LIHTC transactions, you know, a great number of them, it sounds like you have transactions that are, you know, absolutely in front of you now, as well as a big chunk of folks are, you know, looking at sometime in the first half or so of the year. So I think that that's helpful as we talk about how to tactically operate and maneuver within the LIHTC space today. It's helpful for our panelists to know that. A question about your perception of the current market, that also is relatively interesting. Not a big surprise on uncertainty. About a little bit more than 50-50 split on those who have a position on positive versus negative. So that's also quite interesting. Looking at the fourth question about do you have a 2016 transaction that didn't close, over 155 people said, nope, everything in 2016 closed. Congratulations. We're incredibly happy for you. Good job. And then those, you know, the others were spattered across, you know, still working on the solution. I need pre-election pricing. That's about 95 of the 125 that did respond. And about 25% responded saying, you know, I can close with pricing today. So that is also, I think, pretty interesting information and feedback for our clients. For our panelists today, well across the board on you know what people experienced in the fourth quarter, loss of investor, repricing, delayed closing, adjusters. Not a big surprise on the responses there. Again, about you know 80 out of 200 and some, or out of 480 didn't experience that. And again, I think that's fabulous. So. And then the last question, which is pipeline, the number of transactions you expect to see in 2017 is, to me, it's a little bit surprising. I actually would think everybody is going to see fewer deals this year, but, you know, 86 out of the 480 said similar amount, 54 out of the 480 thought they'd see more transactions, kind of a similar amount saying less transactions. And then, obviously, a number that just said, nah, I don't know, and it's uncertain. So I think this is interesting. I think it will help our panelists think about how they might respond in some of these questions. I think it's interesting because I would think the audience seems to maybe err to the side of being positive or optimistic or uncertain. And not as much pessimism maybe as we in the finance markets have been talking about. And it's helpful. It provides some great insight. So thank you all for participating in that. And then without further ado, let's get to the panelists and talk about their perspective on things. So I'm going to start out and maybe ask Christoph. Just if you, starting with you, if you could give the audience just a quick perspective of how Aegon looked at the market in 2016, how your year was, and maybe kind of split the year in pre- and post-election.
Sure, happy to. Well, 2016 started off strongly for us. We ended up having a record year by far. We did over $700 million of equity, and that was about a doubling of years we had previously. Yields were tight at the beginning of the year, and we started to see them ticking up towards the election as investors started to push back on the historical lows. And we were in the market as a direct investor and as a syndicator, as I said, having a record year, and we were in the middle of closing a multi-fund when the election happened. And at that point in time, we lost two of the investors almost immediately thereafter in that multi-fund. We just couldn't make the closing. It was the minority of the investors in the fund. The rest of the investors stayed the course and honored their commitments. On the direct side, we honored our commitments, but we were sort of frozen for a period of a couple of weeks thinking about, okay, what are we going to do? Is this going to be, global financial crisis redux where everybody went to the sidelines? And we came up with a plan of staying in the market. We talked to Transamerica, our affiliate investor, about a plan to stay in the market, and they liked that plan, and we went out and we talked to a bunch of our investors about the same type of plan to remain in the market. Some of those investors said, we want to take a wait-and-see attitude and remain on the sidelines, but a handful of investors, like Citi, said, no, we like this plan, let's stay in the market and be a source of equity. I call those the coalition of the willing.
Great. Thanks, Christoph. Jack, how about Boston Capital's perspective?
Mark, first of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk today. Yes, 2016 certainly was a year that looked extremely favorable as we approached the last quarter. And clearly the prices that we were paying for new transactions, the price was rising over that period of time, all the way till we could say November 7th. And we actually had a multi-investor fund that we had brought to the market during the fourth quarter. And that multi-investor fund was about $260 million. And we ended up getting it done, but it went through a process which was different than what we'd been through before, and yet the net result turned out to be the same. And by that, I mean we realized that on Wednesday morning when we woke up after the election that there was going to have to be some kind of a price adjuster that would come into effect given the fact that tax rates would fall well below 35%. Obviously, the president then was talking about 15% as being the tax rate. Most people do believe that 20% is most likely the lowest number. So we met with all of our investors in this multi-investor fund, and to their credit, the LOIs that had been signed as well as part of this transaction, to their credit, those investors went along with the deal as it was. This is entirely CRA, and the deal did close most of it in 2016, and then we brought in a couple of extra investors who waited until the first couple of weeks of January to sign on. But the transaction is done, and it was done, and I have to give enormous credit to the investing public that they had enough confidence in us and in the developers that we were working with, as well as the state agencies, that they were willing to go along with the existing deal. Now, once we get into 2017, that's a different situation. And it's ironic in a sense that that this industry went for the whole until November. This industry believed that the pricing and the structure and so forth that were being created for every transaction was going to last for quite some period of time. And I don't think any of us really thought that there would be a change in the makeup of the Congress and the presidency and with the consequences that we're all dealing with today. So now it's a totally different story. We happen to be looking at a number of deals that are appealing to us. But here's the key. The key is that for this industry to continue to do well, and it has every potential to do very well, for it to continue to do that, you have to have close working relationships between developer, syndicator, lenders, definitely the state agencies. We all have to be on the same team like never before, particularly what the laws finally are. That's a different story in terms of how deals might get structured. But for the time being, it's very important that we work together as a group and as a team to come up with the best structure so that the programs can continue on. And I think that's what we really have seen in the last 30 days. At least in our business, that's what we've seen very frequently, is that everybody is really working very closely, openly, and aggressively to make this work.
Great. Good. I'll ask a few more questions about that, Jack, when we get into 2017, but thanks. That's a great synopsis of 16. Mark Sherman, how about from your perspective, give us your thoughts on 2016.
Sure, sure. Thanks, Mark. You know, I think overall from our perspective, 2016 was a very big year for Citi in the LIHTC space. Over the past few years, we had been ramping up our origination efforts, and in 2016, we closed just over $1 billion of new origination LIHTC equity, which was a sizable increase over what we had done in the prior year, which was just over $650 million, which, again, was a sizable increase over the year before that. I think my comments in a lot of ways echo what Christoph and Jack have said in the market. I think we saw similar movements in yield in the market that they've already described. I think the one thing I will say about the origination numbers as well, most of those deals were committed to prior to the election. I think we went through a similar process that most investors likely did, where right after the election, the immediate focus was really working through the potential impacts of corporate tax reform, you know, most notably, obviously, the reduction in the corporate tax rate in our existing portfolio and then also our current pipeline. I think that is something that caused a temporary, say, freeze, but, I think it was something that was really done over a very short period of time where we really went through that and evaluated and ultimately made the decision to, remain in the market, look at transactions and evaluate them, both the deals that we had in our current pipeline as well as new transactions, that either we weren't looking at before or, that had come up and, were in the process of being restructured. So, I think ultimately, there's still, we're really going through a period of transition. There's uncertainty in the market because of the corporate tax reform issues out there and really how we're evaluating those transactions. We're trying to address those to the extent possible. And, I think echoing Jack's comment there, being open and transparency and having a lot of discussions with our syndicator partners, with our partners on the lending side, and everybody involved in the transactions is vitally important right now.
Yeah, great. Well, it's funny. It's kind of interesting to hear you guys talk and then go back and take a look at our poll result, the poll results in terms of 2016 business. 155 out of the 480 respondents said everything closed in 2016, which is kind of reflective of Mark, you said, Jack, what you said, Christoph, what you said about investors committing to close out business next year. And then looking at the next question, but there were 220 some of those 480 that either lost an investor or faced repricing. So it sounds like, kind of what you've described for 2016 is also borne out by the respondents in the poll. So let's go to what everybody probably is most interested in is let's talk about 2017. And I'll go back to my theme here, which is looking for uncertainty in an uncertain market. I remember in my days as an investment banker, I used to tell my clients, my goal is to get you a market rate or to at least let you know what the market is. You may not like the market rate, but nonetheless, my goal is to get you a market rate. So, and that goes back to, kind of certainty in an uncertain market. So I'll maybe start off with, Jack, but, and then, Jack, Christoph, and Mark, maybe a little bit less applicable to you, but I'm curious what you can share with our, participants about kind of the current depth and breadth of market investors for 2017?
So, well, what we have seen, well, let's face it, there's nothing worse than uncertainty, and that is what we're dealing with, and it has not been the easiest to figure out how do we best look at our transactions. And we're trying not to get into all of the in this conversation. We're trying not to get into all the legal and tax issues. But obviously, in looking at how much equity we believe a transaction can absorb, we have to take into consideration the 35% down to the 20%. That's the model that we are using. Then one has to also factor in that the investors today do expect to see an increase in yield. and that's an undescribed amount. We don't know what that number really is. There's an awful lot of work to be done to come out with new funds in 2017 that we feel will have broad appeal. But we are hearing lots of demand for investment. So we're in a new world as it stands right now. And so, as I say, we're looking at three components as to how we come up with the price. One is obviously 35% down to 20%. You get 15 points that unfortunately get lost in the pricing. We're thinking somewhere around 5% more goes into just simply lifting the yield. And then you have the issue of debt on the property with interest rates having risen somewhat. So you have those three elements that come into how we're going to price for 2017. Moreover, we also have the issue of how do we factor in different types of funds, how do we factor in the appropriate dollar amount that's put into the fund. For example, if it's proprietary, what we will do is we will hold the equity money back and we will discount, if you will, the amount of equity that's put in will be discounted down to the 20% tax rate, and adjusters will kick in as things actually proceed. So in this case, it would be an adjustment upward if we did it with a proprietary fund based upon a 20% tax rate. If we had a multi-investor fund, because the vast number of deals and the vast number of investors that normally participate, we would raise the equity as if it were 35% with equity held back, but with 35%, and it would be an adjustment downward. So the depth and breadth is very much affected by how a deal is structured. But again, it's very, very important that we also include elements of the transaction like the state agencies. The state agencies are going to be playing a tremendous role in the success or the inability of a project to go forward. And I can talk to you about that a little later. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Great. Thanks, Jack. Christoph, what's your perspective on, and I know all of these topics kind of blend together because you can't really talk about depth and breadth of investors without talking about pricing or yields or whatever, but just, Christoph, what's your thoughts on kind of the current depth and breadth of investors in the marketplace?
You know, it's difficult. There's no sort of clearinghouse where everybody, you know, checks in and says, you know, we're an investor and we're not in the market, or we're an investor and we are in the market. And nobody's done polling, comprehensive polling since the election to see, you know, who's in the market and who isn't. I know that there are people in the market. There are investors in the market. We're in the market. Citi's in the market. Boston Capital's in the market. But what's interesting for me when we're talking about depth and breadth is that developers are obviously looking for different avenues. So there some developers, their normal sources of equity just aren't there, and they're looking for different avenues. When I look at our production pipeline here at Aegon, I focus on two columns. We have a column that shows the number of days a deal has been on the pipeline and also the name of the developer. And two themes emerge. There are lots of new deals on our pipeline, and lots of them are from new relationships. So that's just a reflection of developers looking for different sources of equity because the market is just smaller today.
Great.
Mark, could I
Thank
add
you.
Just one thing?
Yeah, go right ahead, Jack.
You know, as I think about it, it's likely that this year we will have more demand than we have eligible projects. And that's where the issues of what are the components of the capital stack going to look like? How do we know that we're going to, we want developers to make a profit. We would be nervous about developers that don't make a profit whose transaction is proposed to us. So my point is that it's ironic in one respect that it may turn out to be a year where there's more demand than there is supply, mainly because of the tax consequences of the proposed changes.
So, Jack, by more demand than supply, meaning more investor demand versus credits from projects, and that would be because of projects, I mean, not balancing at newer pricing. Well, okay, I'm going to hold that question because it goes into the next thing, which is pricing. But, Mark Sherman, anything you might want to add on depth and breadth of investors?
I'd say the only other thing I can add to that, you know, like we were talking about before, Citi is still open for new business, and we're evaluating deals, you know, both deals that come through our standard origination pipelines, as well as you're looking at quite a few deals where the initial placement of equity fell through, either through a repricing or the investor just dropping away. You know, I think overall our thoughts as we were getting into this year were that we would see a down, you know, a downward adjustment in the amount of new origination live equity that we would do, just ultimately because fewer deals would get done this year. But, you know, right now, if we look at our pipeline for the first quarter, we have about $200 million worth of equity in our pipeline right now, which, you know, obviously isn't a certainty, but, you know, we still are trending and moving forward, and there are deals that, you know, are moving forward and getting done. You know, I will say that, you know, similar to what Jack and Christoph have been saying, I mean, we've been doing our typical review of deals. You know, there's obviously impacts to pricing that we get into, as well as the tax rate assumptions, looking at deals at a 20% tax rate with upward adjusters.
Yeah,
Thank you.
I would add that the depth of the market will likely increase over the year as some of the uncertainty that currently exists bleeds off. So as we start to, as the Hill starts to sort of telegraph the direction of tax reform and some of that uncertainty sort of falls out of the market, I would imagine that some of the investors on the sidelines come back into the market and you start to see the market become more robust.
Well, I'm going to thank Jack for touching the third rail before I ever even had to ask, which was about pricing. So my next question, gentlemen, is going to be about pricing. And Jack, I'm going to go back to your comment, maybe ask you to take the lead here. But, you know, the comment about more demand than supply, I'm assuming, at least as a debt guy, I look at that and say, what you might be saying is, hey, there aren't going to be as many projects happening today, so there'd be less supply and there'll still be investor demand. But I'm assuming one of the reasons why those projects don't work is the equity price, and taking into the factor some of the considerations that we've talked about already about absolute change in tax rates impacting dollar price, but even holding tax rate constant or ignoring it, the fact that investors are looking for higher yields in 17 than they did in 16. So since you touched the third rail first, Jack, let me come back to you and just say, What are your thoughts, and what do you see in pricing in 2017?
that's a very good question. so let me phrase the answer a little more comprehensively, perhaps. In looking at a transaction today, as contrasted with pre-election. Pre-election, we looked at all the fundamentals and operating capabilities and the financing and so forth, and most of that was very conventional in our thinking. Today, that is obviously not the case because of the reduction in the equity that will become available to be put into a transaction. What does become a new and very relevant role is the role that the state agencies are playing. And it does play into, the overall amount of capital that's available. You know, so for example, the agencies have been, first of all, they've been wonderful. They've been extremely helpful and to the developers and to the syndicators and the investors. But here's the important point. They have excess basis. Last year, it wasn't unusual to have 10 to 20% of excess basis that wasn't utilized. Now, many of the agencies are giving back a 9% credit for the additional 10 to 20% of unutilized basis. No more penalties for turning in credits. Soft funds, some of them have. Again, that becomes a limited number. And they can be helpful in getting state tax credits. So for example, one state increased the 2016 credit allocation by 7% on a deal that didn't have an LOI, so that it could they could speed up the closing of it. So it, pricing is going to be more liquid, more more fluid, I should say, than it has been in the past because of the different role that the agencies we believe will play in finding that chunk of money. Hopefully they'll be able to find a lot of it, the chunk of money that can go into the overall capital stack. Otherwise, our pricing, the way we're looking at it today, in a pure tax credit basis, as we used to in the past, except for the adjustments that we made, is it's really, you know, take where they were on your typical deal. Take where you were pre-election. Subtract 15 points. Assuming a 20, because everybody believes really this is a 20% tax rate, subtract 15 points. The fact that investors now want to see a yield increase, because all the 15 points did was just keep your overall return equal to what it was prior to the election. So we think somewhere between, you know, 2 and 5% of a decrease in price will occur there just to boost yield. So that tells you that somewhere around 18 to 20 cents will come out of every dollar that we otherwise would have made as an investment prior to the election. But pay close attention to the role of the state agencies, because I think we're all going to find in this industry that we are going to be very grateful to them for their willingness to be flexible and to fill gaps to the extent that they're able to do that.
Yeah, Jack, you're spot on, and thank you for emphasizing the importance of the agencies in that role, because I think we're starting to see it some places. It is something that probably, I know we have, from the polling, we had a number of HFAs and PHAs on here. You know, it's something that our developer clients should be making sure they're talking with the state agencies about that. I mean, that's a factor from a pricing standpoint that developers might be able to exercise some control and influence on, and certainly state agencies can exercise control and influence. So that's great. Thank you. Christoph, how about from Aegon's perspective, what wisdom do you want to share with us on pricing?
Sure. That's an easy one, because I have no idea what we're paying for the deals that we're signing up. But it's true, because we go into a deal, and we're using a 20% tax rate as one of the adjuster mechanisms. Let's talk about that one. We assume a 20% tax rate, and we come up with an amount of equity that we're willing to commit to the deal. But we don't know if that really is the final equity. It probably isn't. If you know, the pundits are correct that the tax rate will end up at the 25 to 28% range, well, the deal's going to get more equity, and that is going to be part of the pricing. If we get accelerated expensing as opposed to depreciation in tax reform, that could inure to the developer as well. So we're not going to know until the adjusters have been triggered what the pricing was for a deal. We just know the pricing going into a deal. But Jack's right, interest rates are rising, corporate tax rate assumptions are coming down, and the investors' yield expectations are going up.
Yeah.
So then it's highly dependent on the deal. 9% deal, 4% deal. Jack made a point earlier about wanting to make sure that the developers make some money in the transaction. So we wouldn't want to underwrite a deal with zero paid developer fee. We want to make sure there's some profit in there for the developer at the closing. Is the deal CRA? And then some of the pricing is investor dependent. Is it a CRA investor? What type of adjuster are they comfortable with? So there's, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but more applicable in this market than ever, that every deal is a snowflake. For all
it's art versus science, and I can appreciate that. I would also echo, just from the lending community standpoint, we too want to make sure the developer makes money. The developer's got a cash fee. That's an important aspect to us as at Citi as a lender, and I think it's an important aspect for me speaking for the whole lending community. So it is important that people, you know, close a deal with a cash portion of the fee. Mark Sherman, any thoughts from an investor's perspective on pricing?
Maybe I can try to shed some additional light, at least on how we look at pricing and yields from an investor's perspective, really focused on the return side. I think Citi, like most other investors, have our own metrics for evaluating returns on a LIHTC investment. One of the things we've tried to do since the election is really try to take a very quantitative approach to pricing and yield. So really just kind of looking at ignoring everything else that maybe there's less participants in the market or anything, but really just fundamentally, if you look at just solely the changes in interest rates before the election and currently, as well as, tax rate assumptions going from the 35% tax rate to the 20% tax rate, and you really just look at those two and leave everything else the same, you're really looking at an increase of around 100 basis points in yields to get to the same exact return that we would see as an investor before the election. So, that was really something that, I think in a lot of ways is ultimately driving pricing and yields there. It's the combination of things. I mean, the 10-year Treasury has risen by 65 to 70 basis points since the election. A lot of that has been significant and very abrupt movement. And I think that's something that will be there even after there is more certainty around tax reform. I wouldn't necessarily think that yields will revert all the way back down to pre-election levels just because of the movement in rates. In a lot of ways, we're really in a new interest rate environment. It's higher than it was, but, I think still overall, it's historically low compared to, where we've been in years past.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Let's talk a little bit about what the three of you are seeing in the marketplace relative to adjusters and how adjusters are being used to deal with the uncertainty in the marketplace. Because I think there's a couple of different approaches, and I'd be interested to hear, what people are looking at, what investors are looking at. I know myself as a lender, we certainly have a position about adjusters and how to underwrite them. So somebody want to volunteer first for adjusters?
Sure. I'm happy to go forward with it, Mark. I alluded to it a little earlier, and because it's obviously an integral part of any of the transactions that we do, we break ours up into proprietary and multi-investor, and there are differences in how the adjusters are structured in both types of partnerships. The amount would be the same, but how we do it is slightly different. So there are really three levels in which we set up the adjusters. One is the lowest level would be assuming the 20% tax rate with a proprietary investor. That would become an upward adjuster, and that upward adjuster would go from 20 up to 35, assuming that this law, this proposed tax change never goes through, it would ramp back up to 35%. There was some middle adjustments between if the tax bracket were to come to 25 to 28%. We haven't done this, but we did have at least it modeled, in which case it would be an upward or a downward, depending on whether it was 25 versus 28, if it actually came through that way. It would sort of depend on, if a proprietary investor, who the investor and the developer are to come to a conclusion as to whether we go upward or downward, but we would hold back equity in that case. And then the obvious one that would take the current tax rate with a downward adjuster, and the current tax rate stays the way it is. But the equity would be held back until such a time as it was quite clear that the tax rate was not going to change. If it were a multi-investor fund, that would be different because we have lots of investors and a lot more deals that we would be acquiring. And so in that case, all the money, as if it were a 35% tax rate, would be accounted for, not necessarily put into the fund, but accounted for, and it would be a downward adjuster in that case. So now that may change as we go through this process because, again, it's new. Everything that all of us that are talking about it is in a pretty new environment. So, but this is where our position stands right now.
Great, thanks, Jack. Christoph, what do you see?
Well, our first approach was, you know, if there's going to be adjusters, we'd rather they be upwards adjusters because we, the investor, or the representative of the investor, has control of the money, which is sort of the flip side of the coin that Jack was talking about, where you underwrite it at 35% tax rate and you hold back the adjuster. So you're still in control of the money. But I think for planning purposes in the multi-investor format, that probably makes more sense from the investor's perspective. But there's, you know, you could pick something in the middle. You could have assume a tax rate somewhere between 20 and 35% and have both upwards and downwards adjusters. You could sprinkle in some other stuff like deductibility of interest and expensing versus depreciating. You could throw some limits in there about how high up you'll adjust or how low you'll adjust. And one interesting notion that I heard about, I don't know who the syndicator is or the investor is that is applying this methodology, is they're saying, we're underwriting at the 35% tax rate. There are no adjusters. But their yield expectations are much higher. And so if there is an adjustment, they've sensitized their model so that they know with an adjustment, they still have an acceptable yield. If there isn't an adjustment in corporate tax rates, they have the higher yield. That's sort of intriguing. I don't think it's the best one out there for developers, but it's an intriguing adjuster.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. That is interesting. Mark Sherman, let's just quickly kind of go to you, and then we're going to take as much time as we need to on this call today. We have about 560 people online. I'm hoping that means we'll have some questions. But Mark, let me get your perspective on adjusters. I'm going to go to questions, and if we don't have any, I have a few that I'll run by you guys. So,
sure. I think real quick on this, we had seen the market sort of evolve a little bit around the adjuster language right after the election. I think we were relatively early in going out with our proposed adjuster concept, which I think is similar to what Christoph was talking about, looking at things with a 20% tax rate with an upward adjuster incorporated. You know, I think, you know, some of the ones that split the difference where they were upward and downward, or even ones with just solely downward adjusters, were something we were generally opposed to for various reasons, including the impact on the debt side for deals that we do, both debt and equity, and just kind of the overall underwriting, and just the simple fact that we then, on the investor side, control the money. I do think, you know, the way our adjuster is really up as well is really just to try to isolate the impacts of tax reform. So both the corporate tax rate as well as anything else that may come up and change with accelerated depreciation, and factor that in after you run it from the original 20% assumption, factor those things in after a period of time. And, you know, I think I do echo the same comments that, you know, when there is a little bit more certainty coming out of D.C. as far as what tax reform may ultimately look like, the market may, the market may evolve, but at this point, this is the way we're evaluating and looking at deals.
Great, thanks. I'll add my comments that from a debt provider's perspective, adjusters, particularly downward adjusters, can be challenging for us as the lender to underwrite to. They bring a whole host of potential consequences that not only deal with the flow in or out of money, but issues that we as a regulated lender have to deal with about loan to values and loan to repayment sources and that sort of stuff. So I know most of the stuff that we've seen as a lender, we've just rejected anything that has an unlimited downward adjuster, because we as a lender can't quantify that or figure out how to underwrite to it. Upward adjusters are pretty easy for us to deal with, and so are downward adjusters with some sort of limit or cap. So I know this is an equity discussion, but I'll share that perspective from being a lender. We've got about 10 minutes left in the scheduled call. As I mentioned, we'll keep this call going as long as we have questions. But I'm going to maybe interrupt and stop the program. Ron, operator, Why don't you come on and tell folks how to cue themselves up to ask a question?
Yes, indeed. And if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please make sure, if you're using the speakerphone, that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question at this time.
And we do have do you have questions, Ron?
Yes, sir. And we'll take our first question. Please go ahead, caller. Your line's open.
Hi, this is Jill Edwards from Schwab Bank. Can you guys talk about on the adjusters? Can you talk about the timing, time limits, sort of sunset provisions, I guess, if you're calling it that? What those time limits are, and then what happens at the end of that period of time? Thanks.
Sure. This is Christoph, Jill. The adjuster that we're using most frequently today has a point in time in the future, 5 years out, when the calculation is made. What does the what is reality in 5 years? And then you use what is reality to cause the adjustment to happen. If in 5 years there is no new reality, I have to think out loud. If in 5 years the landscape has nothing has happened, then obviously you would adjust at the 35% tax rate. Now,
we went for 5 years also.
Same from series perspective too.
Yeah,
we had talked about an adjuster that, you know, because if tax reform can happen today, and especially if budget reconciliation is used, where tax reform might happen and then it might reverse back in 10 years. We had talked about, well, maybe we should just have an adjuster every year, sort of a pay-as-you-go for some of the benefits. We ended up not adopting that, but it would protect you sort of over the life of the deal.
Yeah, that's kind of where our thinking is that, you know, we've never had these kinds of adjusters in the LIHTC industry, but I understand they have them in, like, renewable energy credits and others. They have a tax reform adjuster, if you will, and it seems like this is the time to adopt it in our industry.
Great. Operator, more questions?
Yes, indeed, and we'll take the next question. Please go ahead, caller. Your line's open. Caller, your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yep.
Oh, terrific. Hi, this is Jennifer Siemens from KeyBank, and along Jill's question with the adjuster, are you seeing or is anybody capping the amount of the adjuster similar to like a timing or a permanent adjuster, or is it an unlimited upward or downward adjuster isolated only to the tax rate? And then secondarily, with regard to the timing of when those adjusters are paid, how are you holding back that equity? I presume that you're holding back that equity for the five-year period.
So I'll let my panelists take that in a moment, but let me just give you, again, our perspective from a lender. This is Mark Dean from Citi speaking. For us to be able to underwrite the debt associated with these projects, there absolutely needs to be what I'll call capitation, both to the dollar amount and the time frame and the consequences. And we took a position really post when deals started to kind of fall apart with investors or unlimited adjusters coming from investors. We took a position that we can't underwrite it. It's not acceptable. And from a lending community, we kind of pushed back on the equity community saying you can't do that because we can't underwrite to it. I don't know if Jack or Christoph or Mark have comments that they want to add to that.
We do have limits on how much we're working with upward adjusters. And the conversations we had internally were that we were not comfortable with an unlimited upwards adjuster. would want to limit the upwards adjuster in several different ways, either to limit it by the remaining deferred developer fee, limited by what the equity would have been at the 35% tax rate, or limited by the yield that we were expecting in that transaction.
Yeah, in our case, also, it is limited by the spread between the 35 and, using the example, the 20%. And our adjuster ranges from 3 to 5 years.
And I think from our perspective, the adjusters are very similar to the way Christoph described them, you know, limitations around either capping them at the size of the deferred developer fee or ultimately capping them at, you know, what the deal would have been run at, assuming a 35% tax rate today and or with specific deal targets in them.
Great. Thank you, guys. Operator, more questions?
Yes, indeed. And we'll take the next question. Caller, please go ahead. Caller, your line is open. And not hearing a response, we'll move to the next question. Please go ahead, caller, your line is open.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Hello. Yep. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, this is Robin Amidon, Low Income Housing Institute in Seattle, Washington. We're a nonprofit developer. I joined a little bit late, so I apologize if this was covered. The thing that I'm confused about is when people speak about a 15 to 20 cent drop and the further adjustment for rising yields because of so-called other better opportunities for investor capital. What's the base that you're starting with? If pricing was at $1.20 in strong CRA pro-growth markets, are you taking that 15-cent drop from $1.20, or are you all presuming some somewhat covert normal price that's different from original LOIs? Such that you're ending up in the low 90s. I just am confused about the starting mark. I've been relying upon the starting mark in LOIs that have now been adjusted, but is that the common practice, or is it just, as you say, a snowflake, so it's up to the sponsor and with whom they've been negotiating?
So, Robin, it's Mark Dean. I don't know if you joined when Jack was kind of talking a little bit about pricing, but just to recap that, I think what I heard was, you know, Jack said, well, you take about 15 points off just for change from a 35% tax rate to a 20% tax rate, and then there's another, you know, 2 to 5 points that come off for a change in yield expectations. So, you know, at least what we had heard from Jack earlier was, you know, from your starting point, somewhere between, you know, 17 and 20 basis points is a broad brush rule of thumb that he's been observing.
Okay.
And it's also, this is Jack, this is the end of January. We really had a little over a month to sort of deal with this. It's still new, and no doubt there will be changes that come along as things evolve. So we're starting with a point based upon reaction we're getting from investors that they are basing their decision originally on a 35% tax bracket, and now we're down to 20, and they're concerned about the cost of construction obviously have gone up also. So risk becomes a bigger element today than it was on November 7th. And not a big change, but it does have an influence on what the overall pricing is. And so I don't think any of us can say with absolute certainty this is what it is or should be. So take my comment and sort of view it as a, you know, in outline form where we believe it is today, where we're seeing a reaction from investors that are comfortable with that, with this type of a structure, and we're not getting a lot of pushback from developers, despite the fact that the developers obviously don't want to have to give up any of their developer profit, nor do we want them to, for that matter. In fact, to add something to it, one of the things that concerns us is that too much of the developer's profit could become obsolete under this situation, and that could create a more dangerous deal to go into. So we don't want to misuse in any way the adjuster. We simply want to have it there for the purpose of wherever this tax rate comes out. We know that these investors are saying we want to keep our yield where we thought we were buying when we invested in it. So yeah. It's a long way around trying to tell you that nobody has an absolute certainty what it needs to be, but we do feel confident that in today's market, that 15-point drop and then between a 3 and a 5 in terms of getting some yield back is the market today. It could change because we are on new territory here, but that's what we're dealing with.
Well, I would say that, I mean, I'm getting input that underwriting to a 25% corporate rate is reasonable and doesn't overreact, and then their adjusters should it go to 20 with some downward limit on how far it could go, because at some point, even if I agree to do the deal for no developer fee, I can't meet that metric of the downward.
Right,
and investors are willing to cap the downward for me so that I'm not bankrupt on a deal in terms of what we earn that sustains our agency. So I hope more investors might consider that approach going forward.
So Robin, we're seeing the approaches all over the board. We work with, as a lender, we see a lot of different equity providers, and we're seeing the approach be all over the board differently. You know, as I think, you know, Christoph said, everything from a pay-as-you-go to a unlimited downward adjuster, different people are taking different approaches. And, I can tell you from a debt provider standpoint and from a developer standpoint, I think people should push back on unlimited downward adjusters because it can't be underwritten. But there's a wide variety of what people are dealing with. And my advice is if you don't like what you're hearing from somebody you've done business with for a long time, it might be worth exploring on the equity side, exploring new relationships, because there are absolutely different perspectives on what's how to deal with this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Operator, next question.
Yes, indeed. And the next question, please go ahead, caller. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Cindy Proctor with Beacon Development Group. I was just wondering, and it might be more the debt side, but I'm not sure. What is the, 9%, everybody can feel comfortable that's going to remain in one shape or form. The California market and the core urban areas were really focused on 4% deals, and seems like the appetite for that with the limited amount of capital out there is getting to be directed to the 9%. Can you speak to the appetite of the 4% tax-exempt deals?
Yeah, so Cindy, it's Mark Dean. I'll say that at least, you know, we do a preponderance of our business is 4% versus 9%. I think we're seeing that market attract capital. The issues or the question is under what terms and conditions it attracts capital. But if I make the analogy back to 2007, when you used to call a syndicator and say I had a 4% deal, they hung up the phone, and then maybe 90 days they called you back. My impression is they're certainly taking the phone calls and open for business on that sort of those transactions. But let me, you know, we've got Jack, Christoph, and Mark Sherman, so let's hear it from their perspective.
Yeah, this is Christoph. We like 4% deals. And we're doing a lot of 4% deals. It's sort of our bread and butter business these days. So,
same for us at City.
Okay. Okay, good, because there was an investor panel yesterday, and it seemed like there was the shying away of the 4% that took place in Northern California and the Bay Area, so I was a little bit concerned since it's such a big market piece down there.
Yeah, well, we haven't seen that. My consultation to you is much like I said to Robin, which is you may have to broaden your network of syndicator investors that you deal with. So, operator, next question.
Yes, indeed. Please go ahead, caller. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. This is Chris Kolbenschlag with Valued Housing. This question is for the panelists. With respect to terms, are you taking the opportunity to maybe where terms have eroded a little bit with respect to maybe the ODG and things like that? Are you taking this opportunity to also make adjustments in that regard?
Hey, this is Christoph. We like to think that our terms never eroded materially, and so I don't think that wholesale we have to make adjustment to terms. But in certain cases where we might have a relationship developer has gotten used to maybe a term that we were not entirely comfortable with, I think that we would take the opportunity now to maybe try to reverse that trend. But if they're a developer that's performed well over time and, you know, stood behind their deals and stood behind their promises, we would, of course, take that into consideration as well.
Yeah, from our perspective at Citi as well, just, you know, one point on that, I mean, I think it's pretty consistent. A lot of it is, you know, relationship and developer specific. You know, I think we've tried to adhere to the same, you know, credit quality and standards throughout the you know, throughout the market, so it's not something that's really being viewed as a broad way to you know, kind of push back entirely on it. But you know, we continue to evaluate the deals the same way we had before.
Jack, any thoughts, sir?
Yeah, but it actually cracked up, so I couldn't hear that very clearly.
The I think the question in a nutshell was, are investors taking this opportunity to renegotiate credit terms in conjunction with the uncertainty in the marketplace?
That's not what we've experienced. The investors that we've been working with, at least up until this point, have been very, very reasonable and you know, very understanding of how this whole situation came about. So we haven't had anything like that as we go into the new market, shall we call it, with the tax proposals that are on the table. Obviously, there's far more attention to the detail of what the pricing should be and how do we get to the yields. And it's still, you know, as I say, it's still a work in process. We're looking at a very substantial portfolio of assets at this point, and we feel positive about it. But, you know, the fact that there's less capital going into every transaction versus what it used to be is of some concern to us.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Operator, do you know, can you tell me how many questions are or how many callers are in the queue here?
Actually, we no longer have any questions holding.
Well, how, isn't that timely?
We did just get a new one, actually.
Okay, let's go with that. And then I'm gonna remind people that there is, if you have a question that, and I'm going to bring this to a close after this next question, but if you have a question that you didn't have a chance to ask, if you want to email that to askcitycommunitycapital@citi.com, we will send that out to our panelists, and we will make sure that you get an answer to your question. So, operator, let's go with the last question then.
Yes, indeed. And caller, please go ahead.
Hi, guys. This is Caleb Roop with the Pacific Companies. Thanks so much for taking the time to produce this for us today, for all of us to listen to. And my question is, I was wondering if you could confirm kind of the total market that there is today. And my numbers kind of say about $12 billion in equity investments that happened in this program. Maybe roughly divided 60% with a 9% program and 40% with a 4% program today. And my question really is, well, one, if you can kind of, if those statistics are generally accurate or if they're off in some way. But my question is, how much of a drop in the market are you guys anticipating, and are you willing and prepared for that? Like from a CRA perspective, as well as from your own internal business projections for the year.
That's an interesting question. I can tell you what our assumption is. We at Boston Capital, we expect to be in the $600 million range. We go on a fiscal year basis, so our fiscal year ends March 31st, so I'm calculating our numbers on that basis. And part of it has to do with the fact that, and when I look forward that way, is that my first quarter would end up fiscally, would end up in June, and I'm hoping by that point there's a proposal on the desk of the president for his signature so we all know what we're dealing with, because that would make a huge difference in what the volume could be. But based upon what we're looking at today, our estimate is that we will most likely stay flat for where we were for this fiscal year, which ends in March. We expect for the fiscal year that ends March 2018 to come in around the same.
Yeah, I think from our perspective at Citi, we're assuming that we'll be down from an origination perspective, somewhere around 30% because of this uncertainty. I think maybe to touch a little bit on the point from a CRA perspective, from our perspective, and I think many other large banks are similar, we've recently completed one of our CRA exam cycles, so we have a longer runway, as far as achieving our goals for the current exam cycle. Now, it's something we obviously manage very closely and continuously on that, but, it's something that we've been planning for on our side ever since the election.
Let me add to Mark Sherman's comments. From a debt perspective at Citi, last year we had a record year. We did about $6 billion of debt. It's kind of two-thirds 4% deal, one-third 9% deal. It's got a heavy scaling towards new construction. From polling my producers, who in turn polled their clients, and going out and talking to developers about what their pipeline looks like, we expect the debt business at Citi to be down somewhere between 25 and 35%. We did $6,280-some-odd transactions last year. We're expecting to do somewhere around $4 billion and maybe 200 transactions. And we're prepared for that. I mean, we think, we look at this and say, kind of like some of the corrections we went through in 07 and 08, we're certainly prepared for it. We're going to certainly continue to support our clients and figure out ways to facilitate developers who might have different needs relative to how they operate in the business. I'm sorry, Christoph, I think I might have walked over you at first.
That's right. Now, Caleb, I think your estimate of total market size is generally in line with what it really is. I'm for our business here at Aegon, we never expected to do as much business as we did last year, because last year was really a blowout year. But I still feel pretty bullish that we're going to be able to hit our number for this year, especially based on the amount of volume that we're transacting during this first quarter. But if I'm wrong, business is business. We are willing and able to accept a downward amount of volume based on market conditions.
All right, thanks.
All righty. Well, I'm going to bring this to a close. This is by far, it's obviously a fascinating topic. Jack, Christoph, Mark, I couldn't have asked for a better group of panelists than the three of you. I think while we don't repeat topics usually throughout the course of the year, we may find ourselves having another call like this later in the year. I do know we'll have a call later in the year that will be more detailed about the mechanics of the nuts and bolts of politically what's going on. We had a call, I think, in December with David Gasson from Boston Capital, who works for Jack, and Michael Novogradic on that. We'll probably bring that back as well as another kind of status of the LIHTC industry. Again, ask questions to ask City Community Capital at city.com. If you're going to send a question there, we'll get it answered. This will also be available. The whole webinar will be available for an audio replay on our website at citycommunitycapital.com. I want to thank my panelists. I want to thank, we had, I think, close to 600 people dial in today for this phone call. So obviously a very hot topic and good information relative to it. So with that, I bid you all a good day and hope that your source and use always balances.
Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And that'll conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation. You may now disconnect.